1969. Muggy heat blurred the morning into a haze of no sea, no sky. Joe walked out of the sheriff's building and met Ed getting out of the patrol truck.
Come on over here, Sheriff. Got more from the lab on the Chase Andrews case. Hot as a boar's breath inside.
He led the way to a large oak, its ancient roots punching through the bare dirt like fists. The sheriff followed, crunching acorns, and they stood in the shade, faces to the sea breeze. He read out loud.
Bruising on the body, interior injuries consistent with an extensive fall. He did bang the back of his head on that beam. The blood and hair samples matched his, which caused severe bruising and damage to the posterior lobe, but didn't kill him. There you have it. He died where we found him. Had not been moved. The blood and hair on the crossbeam prove it. Cause of death? Sudden impact on occipital and parietal lobe of the posterior cerebral cortex, severed spine, from falling off the tower. So somebody did destroy all the foot and fingerprints. Anything else? Listen to this. They found lots of foreign fibers on his jacket. Red wool fibers that didn't come from any of his clothes. Sample included.
The sheriff shook a small plastic bag. Both men peered at the fuzzy red threads flattened against the plastic like spider webbing.
Wool, it says. Could be a sweater, scarf, hat, Joe said. Shirt, skirt, socks, cape, hell, it could be anything. And we have to find it.
Chapter 15. The Game, 1960. The next noon, hands on her cheeks, Kaya approached the stump slowly, almost in prayer. But no feather on the stump. Her lips pinched. Of course. I gotta leave something for him. Her pocket brought a tail feather from an immature bald eagle she'd found that morning. Only someone who knew birds well would know this splotchy, tatty feather was eagle. A 3-year-old, not yet crowned. Not as precious as the tail feather of the tropic bird, but still a dear thing. She laid it carefully on the stump with a little rock on top, pinned from the wind. That night, arms folded under her head, she lay on her porch bed, a slight smile on her face. Her family had abandoned her to survive a swamp, but here was someone who came on his own, leaving gifts for her in the forest. Uncertainty lingered, but the more she thought about it, the less likely it seemed the boy meant her harm. It didn't fit that anyone who liked birds would be mean. The next morning, she sprang from bed and went about doing what Ma had called a deep clean. At Ma's dresser, Kaya meant only to call the remnants of the drawers. But as she picked up her mother's brass and steel scissors, the finger holes curled and shaped with intricate patterns of lilies, she suddenly pulled back her hair, not trimmed since Ma left more than 7 years ago, and cut off 8 inches. Now it fell just below her shoulders. She looked at herself in the mirror, tossed her head a bit, smiled, scrubbed her fingernails and brushed her hair till it shone. Replacing the brush and scissors, she looked down among some of Ma's old cosmetics. The liquid foundation in rouge had dried and cracked, but the shelf life of lipstick must be decades because when she opened a tube, it looked fresh. For the first time, never having played dress-up as a little girl, she put some on her lips, smacked, then smiled again in the mirror. Thought she looked a bit pretty. Not like Ma, but pleasing enough. She giggled, then wiped it off. Just before closing the drawer, she saw a bottle of dried-up Revlon fingernail polish. Barely pink. Kaya lifted the little jar. Remembering how Ma had walked back from town one day with this bottle of fingernail polish, of all things, Ma said it would look real good with their olive skin. She lined up Kaya and her two older sisters in a row on the faded sofa, told them to stick out their bare feet and painted all those toes and then their fingernails. Then she did her own, and they laughed and had a fine time flouncing around the yard, flashing their pink nails. Pa was off somewhere, but the boat was moored at the lagoon. Ma came up with the idea of all the girls going out in the boat, something they had never done. They climbed into the old skiff, still cavorting like they were tipsy. It took a few pulls to get the outboard cranked, but finally it jumped to, and off they went. Ma steering across the lagoon and into the narrow channel that led to the marsh. They breezed along the waterways. But Ma didn't know all that much about it, and when they went into a shallow lagoon, they got stuck in gummy black mud thick as tar. They pulled this way and that, but couldn't budge. There was nothing left to do but climb over the side, skirts and all, sinking in the muck up to their knees. Ma hollering, "Now don't turn it over, girls, don't turn it over!" They hauled on the boat until it was free, squealing at one another's muddy faces. It took some doing to get back in, flopping over the side like so many landed fish. And instead of sitting on the seats, the four of them squinched up on the bottom of the boat all in a line, holding their feet to the sky, wiggling their toes, their pink nails gleaming through the mud. Lying there, Ma said, "Y'all listen now. This is a real lesson in life. Yes, we got stuck, but what'd we girls do? We made it fun. We laughed. That's what sisters and girlfriends are all about. Sticking together even in the mud. Especially in mud." Ma hadn't bought any polish remover, so when it began to peel and chip, they had faded patchy pink nails on all their fingers and toes, reminding them of the good time they'd had and that real life lesson. Looking at the old bottle, Kaya tried to see her sisters' faces and said out loud, "Where are ye now, Ma? Why didn't you stick?" As soon as she reached the oak clearing the next afternoon, Kaya saw bright, unnatural colors against the muted greens and browns of the forest. On the stump was a small red and white milk carton, and next to it, another feather. It seemed the boy had upped the ante. She walked over and picked up the feather first. Silver and soft, it was from the crest of a night heron, one of the most beautiful of the marsh. Then she looked inside the milk carton. Rolled up tight were some packages of seeds, turnips, carrots, and green beans. And at the bottom of the carton, wrapped in brown paper, a spark plug for her boat engine. She smiled again and turned a little circle. She had learned how to live without most things, but now and then she needed a spark plug. Jumpin' had taught her a few minor engine repairs, but every part meant a walk to town and cash money. And yet here was an extra spark plug, to be set aside until needed. A surplus. Her heart filled up. The same feeling as having a full tank of gas, or seeing the sunset under a paintbrushed sky. She stood absolutely still, trying to take it in, what it meant. She had watched male birds wooing females by bringing them gifts, but she was pretty young for nesting. At the bottom of the carton was a note. She unfolded it and looked at the words, written carefully in simple script that a child could read. Kaya knew the time of the tides in her heart, could find her way home by the stars, knew every feather of an eagle, but even at 14, couldn't read these words. She had forgotten to bring anything to leave. Her pockets yielded only ordinary feathers, shells, and seed pods. So she hurried back to the shack and stood in front of her feather wall, window shopping, The most graceful were the tail feathers from a tundra swan. She took one from the wall to leave at the stump next time she passed. As evening fell, she took her blanket and slept in the marsh, close to a gully full of moon and mussels, and had two tow bags filled by dawn. Gas money. They were too heavy to tote, so she dragged the first one back toward the lagoon. Even though it wasn't the shortest route, she went by way of the oak clearing to leave the swan feather. She walked into the trees without looking, and there, leaning against the stump, was the feather boy. She recognized him as Tate, who had shown her the way home through the marsh when she was a little girl. Tate, who for years she had watched from a distance without the courage to go near. Of course, he was taller and older, probably 18. His golden hair stuck out from his cap in all manner of curls and loose bits, and his face was tan, pleasing. He was calm, smiled wide, his whole face beaming. But it was his eyes that caught her up. They were golden brown with flecks of green, and fixed on hers the way heron eyes catch a minnow. She halted, shaken by the sudden break in the unwritten rules. That was the fun of it, a game where they didn't have to talk or even be seen. Heat rose in her face.
"Hey, Kaya, please don't run. It's just me, Tate,"
he said very quietly, slowly, like she was dumb or something. That was probably what the townspeople said of her, that she barely spoke human. Tate couldn't help staring. She must be 13 or 14, he thought. But even at that age, she had the most striking face he'd ever seen. Her large eyes nearly black, her nose slender over shapely lips, painted her in an exotic light. She was tall, thin, giving her a fragile, lithesome look as though molded wild by the wind. Yet young strapping muscles showed through with quiet power. Her impulse, as always, was to run. But there was another sensation. A fullness she hadn't felt for years, as if something warm had been poured inside her heart. She thought of the feathers, the spark plug, and the seeds. All of it might end if she ran. Without speaking, she lifted her hand and held the elegant swan feather toward him. Slowly, as though she might spring like a startled fawn, he walked over and studied it in her hand. She watched in silence, looking only at the feather, not his face, nowhere near his eyes.
"Tundra swan, right? Incredible, Kaya. Thank you," he said.
He was much taller and bent slightly as he took it from her. Of course, this was the time for her to thank him for his gifts. But she stood silent, wishing he would go, wishing they could stick to their game. Trying to fill the silence, he continued.
"My dad's the one who taught me birds."
Finally, she looked up at him and said,
"I can't read your note."
"Well, sure, since you don't go to school." "I forgot. All it said was, I saw you a couple of times when I was fishing, and it got me thinking that maybe you could use the seeds and the spark plug. I had extra and thought it might save you a trip to town. I figured you'd like the feathers."
Kaya hung her head and said,
"Thank you for them. That was mighty fine of you."
Tate noticed that while her face and body showed early inklings and foothills of womanhood, her mannerisms and turns of phrase were somewhat childlike, in contrast to the village girls whose mannerisms, overdoing their makeup, cussing, and smoking, outranked their foothills.
"You're welcome. Well, I better be going. Getting late. I'll drop by now and then, if that's okay."
Kaya didn't say a word to that. The game must be over. As soon as he realized she wasn't going to speak again, he nodded to her, touched his hat, and turned to go. But just as he ducked his head to step into the brambles, he looked back at her.
"You know, I could teach you to read."
Chapter 16. Reading. 1960. For days, Tate didn't return for the reading lessons. Before the feather game, loneliness had become a natural appendage to Kaya, like an arm. Now it grew roots inside her and pressed against her chest. Late one afternoon, she struck out in her boat.
"I can't just sit round waiting."
Instead of docking at Jumpin's, where she'd be seen, she stashed her rig in a small cove just south and, carrying a croaker sack, walked down the shaded path toward Colored Town. A soft rain had fallen most of the day, and now, as the sun neared the horizon, the forest formed its own fog that drifted through succulent glades. She'd never gone to Colored Town, but knew where it was and figured she could find Jumpin' and Mabel's place once she got there. She wore jeans and a pink blouse from Mabel. In the croaker sack were 2-pint jars of real runny blackberry jam she'd made herself to return Jumpin' and Mabel's kindness. A need to be with someone, a chance to talk with a woman friend, urged her toward them. If Jumpin' wasn't home yet, maybe she could sit down with Mabel and visit a spell. Then, nearing a bend in the road, Kaya heard voices coming toward her. She stopped, listened carefully. Quickly, she stepped off the path into the woods and hid behind a myrtle thicket. A minute later, 2 white boys, dressed in raggedy bib overalls, came around the bend, toting fishing tackle and a string of catfish long as her arm. She froze behind the thicket and waited. One of the boys pointed down the lane.
"Looky up there. Ain't we lucky? Here comes a nigger walking to Nigger Town."
Kaya looked down the path, and there, walking home for the evening, was Jumpin'. Quite close, he had surely heard the boys, but he simply dropped his head, stepped into the woods to give them a berth, and moved on.
"What's the matter with him? Why don't he do somethin'?"
Kaya raged to herself. She knew nigger was a real bad word. She knew by the way Pa had used it like a cuss word. Jumpin' could have knocked the boys' heads together, taught them a lesson. But he walked on fast.
"Just an old nigger walking to town. Watch out, nigger boy. Don't fall down."
They taunted Jumpin', who kept his eyes on his toes. One of the boys reached down, picked up a stone, and slung it at Jumpin's back. It hit just under his shoulder blade with a thud. He lurched over a bit, kept walking. The boys laughed as he disappeared around the bend. Then they picked up more rocks and followed him. Kaya stalked through brush until she was ahead of them, her eyes glued on their caps bobbing above the branches. She crouched at a spot where thick bushes grew next to the lane, where in seconds they would pass within a foot of her. Jumpin' was up ahead, out of sight. She twisted the cloth bag with the jam so that it was wrung tight and knotted against the jars. As the boys drew even in the thicket, she swung the heavy bag and whacked the closest one hard across the back of his head. He pitched forward and fell on his face. Hollering and screeching, she rushed the other boy, ready to bash his head too. But he took off. She slipped about 50 yards into the trees and watched until the first boy stood, holding his head and cussing. Toting the bag of jam jars, she turned back toward her boat and motored home. Thought she'd probably never go visitin' again. The next day, when the sound of Tate's motor chugged through the channel, Kaya ran to the lagoon and stood in the bushes, watching him step out of his boat, holding a rucksack. Looking around, he called out to her, and she stepped slowly forward, dressed in jeans that fit
in a white blouse with mismatched buttons.
Hey, Kaya. Sorry I couldn't get here sooner. Had to help my dad. But we'll get you reading in no time.
Hey, Tate.
Let's sit here.
He pointed to an oak knee in deep shade of the lagoon. From the rucksack, he pulled out a thin, faded book of the alphabet and a lined writing pad. With a careful, slow hand, he formed the letters between the lines. Little A, big A, little B, big B, asking her to do the same, patient with her tongue-between-lips effort. As she wrote, he said the letters out loud, softly, slowly. She remembered some of the letters from Jody and Ma, but didn't know much at all about putting them into proper words. After only minutes, he said,
"See? You can already write a word."
"What do you mean?"
"C-A-B. You can write the word cab."
"What's cab?"
she asked. He knew not to laugh.
"Don't worry if you don't know it. Let's keep going. Soon you'll write a word you know."
Later, he said,
"You'll have to work lots more on the alphabet. It'll take a little while to get it, but you can already read a bit. I'll show you."
He didn't have a grammar reader, so her first book was his dad's copy of Aldo Leopold's A Sand County Almanac. He pointed to the opening sentence and asked her to read it back to him. The first word was there, and she had to go back to the alphabet and practice the sound of each letter, but he was patient, explaining the special sound of TH, and when she finally said it, she threw her arms up and laughed. Beaming, he watched her. Slowly, she unraveled each word of the sentence.
"There are some who can live without wild things, and some who cannot."
"Oh," she said.
"Oh.
You can read, Kaya. There will never be a time again when you can't read."
"It ain't just that,"
she spoke almost in a whisper.
"I wasn't aware that words could hold so much. I didn't know a sentence could be so full."
He smiled.
"That's a very good sentence. Not all words hold that much."
Over the coming days, sitting on the oak knee in shade or the shore in sun, Tate taught her how to read the words, which sang of the geese and cranes, real all around them.
"What if there be no more goose music?"
In between helping his dad or pitching baseball with his friends, he came to Kaya's place several times a week, and now, no matter what she was doing, weeding the garden, feeding the chickens, searching for shells, she listened for the sound of his boat humming up the channel. On the beach one day, reading about what chickadees eat for lunch, she asked him,
"You live with your family in Barkley Cove?"
"I live with my dad. Yes, in Barkley."
Kaya didn't ask if he had more family, now gone. His ma must have left him too. Part of her longed to touch his hand, a strange wanting. But her fingers wouldn't do it. Instead, she memorized the bluish veins on the inside of his wrist, as intricate as those sketched on the wings of wasps. At night, sitting at the kitchen table, she went over the lessons by kerosene lamp, its soft light seeping through the shack windows and touching the lower branches of the oaks. The only light for miles and miles of blackness, except for the soft glow of fireflies. Carefully, she wrote and said each word over and over. Tate said long words were simply little ones strung together, so she wasn't afraid of them, went straight to learning Pleistocene along with Sat. Learning to read was the most fun she'd ever had. But she couldn't figure why Tate had offered to teach Paul white trash like her. Why he'd come in the first place, bringing exquisite feathers. But she didn't ask, afraid it might get him thinking on it, send him away. Now, at last, Kaya could label all her precious specimens. She took each feather, insect, shell, or flower, looked up how to spell the name in Ma's books, and wrote it carefully on her brown paper bag painting. "What comes after 29? She asked Tate one day. He looked at her. She knew more about tides and snow geese, eagles and stars than most ever would, yet she couldn't count to 30. He didn't want to shame her, so didn't show surprise. She was awfully good at reading eyes. 30, he said simply. Here, I'll show you the numbers and we'll do some basic arithmetic. It's easy. I'll bring you some books about it. She went around reading everything. The directions on the grits bag, Tate's notes, and the stories from her fairy tale books she had pretended to read for years. Then one night she made a little O sound and took the old Bible from the shelf. Sitting at the table, she turned the thin pages carefully to the one with the family names. She found her own at the very bottom. There it was, her birthday. Miss Catherine Danielle Clark, October 10th, 1945. Then going back up the list, she read the real names of her brothers and sisters. Master Jeremy Andrew Clark, January 2nd, 1939. Jeremy, she said out loud. Jody, I sure never thought of you as Master Jeremy. Miss Amanda Margaret Clark, May 17th, 1937. Kaya touched the name with her fingers, repeated it several times. She read on. Master Napier Murphy Clark, April 4th, 1936. Kaya spoke softly.
Murph, your name was Napier.
At the top, the oldest, Miss Mary Helen Clark, September 19th, 1934. She rubbed her fingers over the names again, which brought faces before her eyes. They blurred, but she could see them all squeezed around the table eating stew, passing cornbread, even laughing some. She was ashamed that she had forgotten their names. But now that she'd found them, she would never let them go again. Above the list of children, she read, Mr. Jackson Henry Clark married Miss Julianne Maria Jacques, June 12, 1933. Not until that moment had she known her parents' proper names. She sat there for a few minutes with the Bible open on the table, her family before her. Time ensures children never know their parents young. Kaya would never see the handsome Jake swagger into an Asheville soda fountain in early 1930, where he spotted Maria Jacques, a beauty with black curls and red lips, visiting from New Orleans. Over a milkshake, he told her his family owned a plantation, and that after high school he'd study to be a lawyer and live in a columned mansion. But when the Depression deepened, the bank auctioned the land out from under the Clark's feet, and his father took Jake from school. They moved down the road to a small pine cabin that once, not so long ago, really, had been occupied by slaves. Jake worked the tobacco fields, stacking leaves with black men and women, babies strapped on their backs with colorful shawls. One night, 2 years later, without saying goodbye, Jake left before dawn, taking with him as many fine clothes and family treasures, including his great-grandfather's gold pocket watch and his grandmother's diamond ring, as he could carry. He hitchhiked to New Orleans and found Maria living with her family in an elegant home near the waterfront. They were descendants of a French merchant, owners of a shoe factory. Jake pawned the heirlooms and entertained her in fine restaurants hung with red velvet curtains, telling her that he would buy her that columned mansion. As he knelt under a magnolia tree, she agreed to marry him, and they wed in 1933 in a small church ceremony, her family standing silent. By now, the money was gone, so he accepted a job from his father-in-law in the shoe factory. Jake assumed he would be made manager, but Mr. Jacques, a man not easily taken in, insisted Jake learn the business from the bottom up like any other employee. So Jake labored at cutting out soles. He and Maria lived in a small garage apartment, furnished with a few grand pieces from her dowry, mixed with flea market tables and chairs. He enrolled in night classes to finish high school, but usually skipped out to play poker, and stinking of whiskey, came home late to his new wife. After only 3 weeks, the teacher dropped him from the classes. Maria begged him to stop drinking, to show enthusiasm for his job so that her father would promote him. But the babies started coming and the drinking never stopped. Between 1934 and 1940, they had 4 children, and Jake was promoted only once. The war with Germany was an equalizer. Boiled down to the same uniform hue as everyone else, he could hide his shame, once again play proud. But one night, sitting in a muddy foxhole in France, someone shouted that their sergeant was shot and sprawled bleeding 20 yards away. Mere boys, they should have been sitting in a dugout waiting to bat, nervous about some fastball. Still, they jumped at once, scrambling to save the wounded man. All but one. Jake hunched in a corner, too scared to move. But a mortar exploded yellow-white just beyond the hole, shattering the bones of his left leg into fragments. When the soldiers tumbled back into the trench, dragging the sergeant, they assumed Jake had been hit while helping the others rescue their comrade. He was declared a hero. No one would ever know, except Jake. With a medal and a medical discharge, he was sent home. Determined not to work again in the shoe factory, Jake stayed only a few nights in New Orleans. With Maria standing by silently, he sold all her fine furniture and silver, then packed his family onto the train and moved them to North Carolina. He discovered from an old friend that his mother and father had died, clearing the way for his plan. He'd convinced Maria that living in a cabin his father had built as a fishing retreat on the coast of North Carolina would be a new start. There would be no rent, and Jake could finish high school. He bought a small fishing boat in Barkley Cove and motored through miles of marsh waterways with his family and all their possessions piled around them, a few fine hat boxes perched on top. When they finally broke into the lagoon, where the ratty shack with rusted-out screens hunkered under the oaks, Maria clutched her youngest child, Jody, fighting tears. Pa assured her, "Don't you worry, Nan. I'll get this fixed up in no time." But Jake never improved the shack or finished high school. Soon after they arrived, he took up drinking and poker at the Swamp Guinea, trying to leave that foxhole in a shot glass. Maria did what she could to make a home. She bought sheets from rummage sales for the floor mattresses and a standalone tin bathtub. She washed the laundry under the yard spigot and figured out on her own how to plant a garden, how to keep chickens. Soon after they arrived, dressed in their best, she hiked the children to Barkley Cove to register them in school. Jake, however, scoffed at the notion of education, and more days than not, told Murph and Jody to skip school and bring in squirrels or fish for supper. Jake took Maria for only one moonlit boat ride, the result of which was their last child, a daughter named Catherine Danielle, later nicknamed Kaya because, when first asked, that's what she said her name was. Now and then, when sober,
Jake dreamed again of completing school, making a better life for them all. But the shadow of the foxhole would move across his mind. Once sure and cocky, handsome and fit, he could no longer wear the man he had become, and he'd take a swig from his poke. Blending in with the fighting, drinking, cussing renegades of the marsh was the easiest thing Jake ever did. Chapter 17. Crossing the Threshold. 1960. One day, during the reading summer when she motored to Jumpin's, he said,
"Now, Miss Kaya, there's something else. Some men been poking round asking about you."
She looked right at him instead of off to the side.
"Who? What'd they want?"
"I believe they're from the social services. They're asking all kinds of questions. Is your pa still round? Where your ma is? If you're going to school this fall? And when you come here? They especially want to know what times you come here."
"What'd you tell them, Jumpin'?"
"Well, I done my best to put them off you. Told them your pa just fine. I'll fishin's all."
He laughed, threw his head back.
"Then I told them I never know when you're boat in here. Now don't you worry none, Miss Kyle. Jumpin' will send them on a snipe hunt if they come again."
"Thank you."
After filling her tank, Kaya headed straight home. She'd have to be on guard more now. Maybe find a place in the marsh where she could hide out some until they gave up on her. Late that afternoon, as Tate pulled up to the shore, the hull crunching softly on sand, she said,
"Can we meet somewhere else, sides here?"
"Hey, Kaya, good to see you,"
Tate greeted her, still sitting at the tiller.
"What do you think?"
"It's besides, not sides, and it's polite to greet people before asking a favor."
"You say sides sometimes,"
she said, almost smiling.
"Yeah, we all got magnolia mouth, being from the North Carolina sticks, but we have to try."
"Good afternoon, Mr. Tate,"
she said, making a little curtsy. He caught a glimpse of the spunk and sass somewhere inside.
"Now, can we meet somewhere besides here? Please?"
"Sure, I guess. But why?"
"Jumpin' said the social services are looking for me. I'm scared they'll pull me in like a trout. Put me in a foster home or somethin'."
"Well, we better hide way out there where the crawdads sing. I pity any foster parents who take you on."
Tate's whole face smiled.
"What do you mean, where the crawdads sing? Ma used to say that."
Kaya remembered Ma always encouraging her to explore the marsh.
"Go as far as you can, way out yonder where the crawdads sing."
"Just means far in the bush where critters are wild, still behaving like critters. Now, you got any ideas where we can meet?"
"There's a place I found one time, an old fallen-down cabin. Once you know the turnoff, you can get there by boat. I can walk there from here."
"Okay, then, get in. Show me this time. Next time we'll meet there."
"If I'm out there, I'll leave a little pile of rocks right here by the tying-up log."
Kaya pointed to a spot on the lagoon beach.
"Otherwise, I'm round here somewhere, and will come out when I hear your motor."
They puttered slowly through the marsh, then planed off south through open sea, away from town. She bounced along in the bow, wind tears streaming across her cheeks and tickling cool in her ears. When they reached a small cove, she guided him up a narrow freshwater creek hung low with brambles. Several times the creek seemed to peter out, but Kaya motioned that it was okay to go on, and they crashed through more brush. Finally, they broke into a wide meadow where the stream ran by an old one-room log cabin, collapsed on one end. The logs had buckled, some lying around the ground like pickup sticks. The roof, still sitting on the half wall,
sloped down from high end to low like a lopsided hat. Tate pulled the boat up onto the mud, and they silently walked to the open door. Inside was dark and reeked of rat urine.
"Well, I hope you don't plan on living here. The whole thing could collapse on your head."
Tate pushed at the wall. It seemed sturdy enough.
"It's just a hideout. I can stash some food in case I have to go on a run a while."
Tate turned and looked at her as their eyes adjusted to the dark.
"Kaya, you ever thought of just going back to school? It wouldn't kill you. And they might leave you alone if you did."
"They must have figured out I'm alone. And if I go, they'll grab me, put me in a home. Anyway, I'm too old for school now. Where would they put me? First grade?"
Her eyes widened at the notion of sitting in a tiny chair, surrounded by little kids who could pronounce words, count to 50.
"What, so you plan to live alone in the marsh forever?"
"Better than going to a foster home. Pa used to say he'd farm us out to one if we were bad.
Told us they're mean." "No, they're not. Not always. Most of them are nice people who like kids," he said.
"You'd saying you'd go to a foster home before you'd live in the marsh?"
she asked, chin jutted out, hand on her hip. He was silent a minute.
"Well, bring some blankets out. Matches in case it gets cold. Maybe some tins of sardines. They last forever. But don't keep fresh food. It'll bring the bears in."
"I ain't scared of bears."
"I'm not scared of bears."
For the rest of the summer, Kaya and Tate did the reading lessons at the tumble-down cabin. By mid-August, they had read through a Sand County almanac, and although she couldn't read every word, she got most of it. Aldo Leopold taught her that floodplains are living extensions of the rivers, which will claim them back any time they choose. Anyone living on a floodplain is just waiting in the river's wings. She learned where the geese go in winter, and the meaning of their music. His soft words, sounding almost like poetry, taught her that soil is packed with life and one of the most precious riches on earth, that draining wetlands dries the land for miles beyond, killing plants and animals along with the water. Some of the seeds lie dormant in the desiccated earth for decades, waiting, and when the water finally comes home again, they burst through the soil, unfolding their faces. Wonders and real-life knowledge she would have never learned in school. Truths everyone should know, yet somehow, even though they lay exposed all around, seemed to lie in secret like the seeds. They met at the log cabin several times a week, but she slept most nights in her shack or on the beach with the gulls. She had to collect firewood before winter, so made a mission of it, toting loads from near and far and stacking them somewhat neatly between two pines. The turnips in her garden barely poked their heads above the goldenrod. Still, she had more vegetables than she and the deer could eat. She harvested the last of the late summer crop and stored the squash and beets in the cool shade of the brick-and-board steps. But all the while, she kept her ears out for the lugging sounds of an automobile, filled with men come to take her away. Sometimes the listening was tiresome and creepy. So she'd walk to the log cabin and sleep the night on the dirt floor, wrapped in her spare blanket. She timed her mussel collecting and fish smoking so that Tate could take them to Jumpin's and bring her back supplies, keeping her underbelly less exposed.
"Remember when you read your first sentence? You said that some words hold a lot," Tate said one day, sitting on the creek bank.
"Yeah, I remember. Why?"
"Well, especially poems. The words in poems do more than say things. They stir up emotions, even make you laugh."
"Ma used to read poems, but I don't remember any."
"Listen to this. It's by Edward Lear.
He took out a folded envelope and read,
Then Mr. Daddy Longlegs and Mr. Floppy Fly rushed downward to the foamy sea with one spontaneous cry. And there they found a little boat whose sails were pink and gray, and off they sailed among the waves far and far away.
Smiling, she said, It makes a rhythm like waves hitting the beach. After that, she went into a poem-writing phase, making them up as she boated through the marsh or looked for shells. Simple verses, sing-song and silly.
There's a mama blue jay lifting from a branch. I'd fly, too, if I had a chance.
They made her laugh out loud, filled up a few lonely minutes of a long, lonely day. One late afternoon, reading at the kitchen table, she remembered Ma's book of poetry and scrounged until she found it. The volume so worn, the covers had long since gone, the pages held together by two frayed rubber bands. Kaya carefully took them off and thumbed through the pages, reading Ma's notes in the margins. At the end was a list of page numbers of Ma's favorites. Kaya turned to one by James Wright.
Suddenly lost and cold, I knew the yard lay bare. I longed to touch and hold my child, my talking child, laughing or tame or wild. Trees and the sun were gone, everything gone but us. His mother sang in the house and kept our supper warm, and loved us, God knows how, the wide earth darkened so.
And this one by Galway Kinnell.
I did care. I did say everything I thought in the mildest words I knew. And now I have to say I am relieved it is over. At the end, I could feel only pity for that urge toward more life. Goodbye.
Kaya touched the words as if they were a message, as though Ma had underlined them specifically so her daughter would read them someday by this dim kerosene flame and understand. It wasn't much, not a handwritten note tucked in the back of a sock drawer, but it was something. She sensed that the words clinched a powerful meaning, but she couldn't shake it free. If she ever became a poet, she'd make the message clear.
After Tate started his senior year in September, he couldn't come to Kaya's place as often. But when he did, he brought her discarded textbooks from school. He didn't say a word about the biology books being too advanced for her, so she plowed through chapters she wouldn't have seen for 4 years in school.
Don't worry, he'd say. You'll get a little more every time you read it.
And that was true.
As the days grew shorter, again they met near her shack because there wasn't enough daylight to get to the reading cabin. They had always studied outside, but when a crazed wind blew one morning, Kaya built up the fire in the wood stove. No one had crossed the shack's threshold since Pa disappeared more than 4 years ago, and to ask anybody inside would seem unthinkable. Anyone but Tate.
Want to sit in the kitchen by the stove?
She said when he dragged his rig onto the lagoon shore.
Sure,
he said, knowing not to make a big deal of the invitation. As soon as he stepped inside the porch, he took nearly 20 minutes to explore and exclaim over her feathers and shells and bones and nests. When they finally settled at the table, she pulled her chair close to his, their arms and elbows nearly touching, just to feel him near. With Tate so busy helping his dad, the days dragged slow from nose to tail. Late one evening, she took her first novel, Rebecca by Daphne du Maurier, from Ma's bookshelf, and read about love. After a while, she closed the book and walked to the closet. She slipped on Ma's sundress and swished around the room, flipping the skirt about, whirling in front of the mirror. Her mane and hips swaying,
She imagined Tate asking her to dance, his hand on her waist, as if she were Mrs. De Winter. Abruptly, she caught herself and bent over, giggling, then stood very still.
"Come on up here, child,"
Mabel sang out one afternoon.
"I got you some things."
Jumpin' usually brought the boxes of goods for Kaya, but when Mabel showed up, there was usually something special.
"Go on, then, pick up your stuff. I'll fill your tank,"
Jumpin' said. So Kaya hopped onto the wharf.
"Look here, Miss Kaya,"
Mabel said, as she lifted a peach-colored dress with a layer of chiffon over the flowered skirt. The most beautiful piece of clothing Kaya had ever seen, prettier than Ma's sundress.
"This dress is fit for a princess like you."
She held it in front of Kaya, who touched it and smiled. Then, facing away from Jumpin', Mabel leaned over at the middle with some effort and lifted a white bra from the box. Kaya felt heat all over.
"Now, Miss Kaya, don't be shy, hon. You'll be needin' this about now. And, child, if there's ever anything you need to talk to me about, anything you don't understand, you let old Mabel know. You hear?"
Yes'm. Thank you, Mabel."
Kaya tucked the bra deep in the box under some jeans and t-shirts, a bag of black-eyed peas and a jar of put-up peaches. A few weeks later, watching pelicans float and feed in the sea, her boat riding up and down waves, Kaya's stomach suddenly cramped up. She'd never been seasick, and this felt different from any pain she'd ever had. She pulled her boat ashore at Point Beach and sat on the sand, legs folded to one side like a wing. The pain sharpened, and she grimaced, made a little moan. She must have the runs coming. Suddenly, she heard the purr of a motor and saw Tate's rig cutting through the white-capped surf. He turned inland the instant he saw her and made for shore. She spat out some of Pa's cussing. She always liked seeing Tate, but not when she might have to run to the oak woods any second with diarrhea. After dragging his boat next to hers, he plopped down on the sand beside her.
"Hey, Kaya, what are you doing? I was just going out to your place."
"Hey, Tate, it's good to see you."
She tried to sound normal, but her stomach twisted tightly.
"What's wrong?"
he asked.
"What do you mean?"
"You don't look good. What's wrong?"
"I think I'm sick. My stomach's cramping real hard."
"Oh."
Tate looked out over the sea, dug his bare toes in the sand.
"Maybe you should go,"
she said, head down.
"Maybe I should stay till you're better. Suppose you can't get yourself home."
"I might have to go to the woods. I might be sick."
"Maybe, but I don't think that's going to help," he said quietly.
"What do you mean? You don't know what's wrong with me."
"Does this feel different from other stomach aches?"
"Yes."
"You're almost 15, right?"
"Yes.
What's that got to do with it?"
He was quiet a minute, shuffled his feet, digging his toes deeper in the sand. Looking away from her, he said,
"It might be, you know, what happens to girls your age. Remember a few months ago I brought you a pamphlet about it? It was with those biology books."
Tate glanced at her briefly, his face blazing, and looked away again. Kaya dropped her eyes as her whole body blushed.
Of course.
There'd been no Ma to tell her, but indeed, a school booklet Tate had brought explained some. Now her time had come, and here she was, sitting on the beach, becoming a woman right in front of a boy. Shame and panic filled her. What was she supposed to do? What exactly would happen?
How much blood would there be?
She imagined it leaking into the sand around her. She sat silent as a sharp pain racked her middle.
Can you get yourself home?
He asked, still not looking at her.
I think so.
It'll be okay, Kaya. Every girl goes through this just fine. You go on home. I'll follow way back to make sure you get there.
You don't have to.
Don't worry about me. Now get going.
He stood and walked to his boat, not looking at her. He motored out and waited quite far offshore until she headed up coast toward her channel. So far back he was just a speck. He followed until she reached her lagoon. Standing on the bank, she waved briefly to him, her face down, not meeting his eyes. Just as she had figured out most things, Kaya figured out how to become a woman on her own. But the next morning at first light, she boated over to Jumpin's. A pale sun seemed suspended in thick fog as she approached his wharf and looked for Mabel, knowing there was little chance she'd be there. Sure enough, only Jumpin walked out to greet her.
Hi, Miss Kaya. You needin' gas already?
Still sitting in the boat, Kaya answered quietly,
I need to see Mabel.
I'm sorry as can be, child. Mabel ain't here today. Can I help you?
Head down low, she said,
I need to see Mabel bad. Soon.
Well, then.
Jumpin looked across the small bay out to sea and saw no more boats coming in. Anybody needing gas at any time of day and every day, including Christmas, could count on Jumpin being here. He hadn't missed a single day in 50 years, except when their baby angel, Daisy, died. He couldn't leave his post.
You hang on there, Miss Kaya. I'm gonna run up the lane a ways. Get some chillin' to fetch Mabel. Any boat come in, you tell him I'll be right back.
I will. Thank you.
Jumpin hurried up the wharf and disappeared as Kaya waited, glancing out in the bay every few seconds, dreading another boat coming in. But in no time he was back, saying some kids had gone to get Mabel. Kaya should
just wait a spell.
Jumpin busied himself unpacking packets of chewing tobacco on the shelves and generally doing around. Kaya stayed in her boat. Finally, Mabel hurried across the boards, which shook with her swing as if a small piano were being pushed down the wharf. Carrying a paper bag, she didn't bellow out a greeting, as she would have otherwise, but stood on the wharf above Kaya and said quietly,
Morning, Miss Kaya. What's all this about, child? What's wrong, hon?
Kaya dropped her head more, mumbled something Mabel couldn't hear.
Can you get out of that boat, or should I get in there with you?
Kaya didn't answer, so Mabel, almost 200 pounds worth, stepped one foot, then the other, into the small boat, which complained by bumping against the piling. She sat down on the center bench, facing Kaya at the stern.
Now, child, tell me what's wrong.
The two leaned their heads together, Kaya whispering, and then Mabel pulled Kaya right over to her full bosom, hugging and rocking her. Kaya was rigid at first, not accustomed to yielding to hugs, but this didn't discourage Mabel. And finally, Kaya went limp and slumped against the comfort of those pillows. After a while, Mabel leaned back and opened the brown paper bag.
Well, I figured what's wrong. So I brought you some things.
And there, sitting in the boat at Jumpin's Wharf, Mabel explained the details to Kaya.
Now, Miss Kaya, this ain't nothing to be ashamed of. It ain't no curse, like folks say. This here's the starting of all life, and only a woman can do it. You're a woman now, baby.
When Kaya heard Tate's boat the next afternoon, she hid in thick brambles and watched him. For anyone to know her at all seemed strange enough, but now he knew about the most personal and private occurrence of her life. Her cheeks burned at the thought